Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
Reporters at the alternative weekly paper Dig Boston have been reporting on a pilot program that was used during Boston Calling musical festival events on two occasions last year. According to that reporting, the software can analyze taped footage and parse people out by their skin color, the color of their clothing, and other factors. And the reporters found that the footage from the events is still stored on unsecured databases. We're going to be talking with one of those reporters about this, as well as with a member of the ACLU and with a law professor who studies biometrics and talk about the advantages and potential pitfalls of this technology. And we want to get your input. We want to know whether you feel that when a city is piloting a surveillance program, it should tell its residents and visitors that it's doing that? Or at this point, do you just feel that surveillance is a fact of life, that people need to get used to it? Are you more concerned about feeling safe than feeling that your privacy is protected? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And the reporter with us here in the newspaper is Chris Ferrone of The Dig. Chris, thanks for coming in.
Anytime.
So tell us, first of all, give us the big, broad picture of what this software, this technology is, because it's more than just cameras. Cameras have been around for a long time. It goes beyond that.
Yes. In fact, it uses cameras that were already installed in this instance in the government center area. So, you know, it's called, you know, in the fancy term is intelligent video analysis. But really, to put it in terms of what happened at Boston Calling, the major music festival here in the city, and this is in May of 2013, imagine that everybody who comes through the door has not only a camera aimed at them, but a camera that's equipped with software that could essentially parse those individuals by everything ranging from their skin color to what they're wearing, to their hairstyle, to whether they're wearing glasses, if they have a beard. And then, of course, it puts together like a score, that kind of puts all that together, and then that can be weighed or measured against, you know, other people who enter elsewhere. So if they're looking for somebody who fits my description, a beard, a little bald, they can find it.
So they could find everybody with a mohawk, everybody wearing an orange shirt, everybody in a Red Sox cap, that kind of thing.
That's the idea.
You've also written that there are some forms of this technology that can gauge panic, as it's put, or gauge sort of the sentiment of people. How does that work? How is that done?
So they do it through a number of nodes, one, of course, being social media. So one of the technologies we've seen is really almost no different than what you could do with a program you could download like Hootsuite or TweetDeck, searching for keywords. In the case of Boston Calling, looking for people mentioning the word help, maybe, or if they're hurt, things like that.
Anything that indicates kind of mass distress that tips off a problem happening at a large event.
Right. And also kind of monitoring traffic around the venue, foot traffic, pedestrian traffic, certain entrances, if there's a lot of activity there. You know, this is smart video, so smart video analysis. It's capable of not just filming those episodes, but interpreting what's happening to a certain extent.
And Chris, your reporting found that this software was in use to some degree at the Boston Calling events last year in Boston?
Yes. Dig Boston has now collected in various places on the internet a lot of definitive data showing that the city did collect this. And the city has, of course, come forth and told us that that this did indeed happen, not only at the debut Boston Calling in May of 2013, but also at the subsequent one in September.
And we should note this is under the prior mayoral administration. This is when Tom Menino was mayor, not since Marty Walsh has been in office.
Correct.
So what did the city say the purpose of this was?
Well, much like IBM, which is one of the major contractors involved here, the city has told the public about the so-called Smart Cities program in the past and about the technologies. But what they always boast is about how it helps with traffic flow, for example, maybe green maintenance, also traffic lights. I think we have like 60,000 traffic lights, maybe when they're out. What they never boast about, what you never see in the press releases, are some of the implementations that we're discussing here, notably facial recognition, something called face capture that is an IBM technology and those sorts of things. So, you know, I, in my opinion, the city is aware of all the things that it does, but it only kind of advertises those more benevolent uses.
So there were two Boston call-ins last year, as you said, the first in May, the second in September. So one of them is now almost a year and a half in the past. You found, however, that some of this video footage is still available online?
More than 70 hours, actually. And I believe that it is still out there.
And your reporting has focused on why you find that problematic.
A lot of it. So the existence of the data found by my co-author, Kenneth Lipp, that is problematic because it's been out there for, like I said, about 15 months now. And the city, in the city's response, they don't even have a lot of this data still. So, you know, there's really no policy in place, how long it can be retained, et cetera. And this is not the first time we've seen this. So, yeah, that's definitely one of the major concerns that we're looking at going into this series.
Chris, I want to turn to the guest seated next to you here in the studio. This is Cade Crockford. She's director of technology for the Technology for Liberty Project at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Cade, thanks for coming in as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're obviously aware of this program as well. You've read Chris's reporting. Your general thoughts about it?
Well, anytime a city introduces a new surveillance program, and this kind of automated tracking system is certainly one of them, we really have to ask a couple of questions. First, is it doing what it's supposed to set out to do? So does this technology stop mass panic? Does it stop crimes from happening? And the answer is no, obviously. There's been no evidence that even surveillance cameras without these advanced biometric and facial recognition tracking schemes have really any impact on crime rates, especially serious crimes. The second issue that we have to look at, question that we have to ask, is about cost. What are the costs involved, both as far as actual money, resources that the public could be diverting to healthcare, education, feeding people, housing people, and the cost to our civil liberties and our privacy? So that raises a whole separate set of concerns, which is about notice and democratic participation.
That people should be aware.
Not just aware, but we should also play a role in determining what kinds of surveillance policies and technologies cities and states implement.
What's your fear of how this could be used for bad?
Oh, well, I mean, if anyone's seen the film Minority Report or read any, dystopia works of fiction from the 20th century, it's not hard to imagine. We also have cases from real life that we should be thinking about when we look at the deployment of technologies like these. Here in the city of Boston, my organization, the ACLU, put out a report just a few years ago about how the Boston Police Department was documenting the activities of Veterans for Peace and anti-Iraq war organizers, people who were demonstrating for justice in Palestine, calling them terrorists and extremists and labeling them in anti-terrorism databases. So this is actually a really serious problem when our police departments are secretly deploying technologies that implicate our liberty and cost a lot of money.
We did speak with Boston Police, and they said to us that the Boston Police Department, and I'm quoting here, was not part of this initiative. We do not and have not used or possessed this type of technology. We did then contact BPD again today, asking if someone from the department could come on the show. We hadn't heard back as of showtime. Listeners, we are talking about a pilot software that was deployed during the Boston Calling Music Festivals last year, in which basically it's a kind of software, and Cade and Chris, tell me if I'm summarizing this quickly. It's not so much the cameras as the software used to process and analyze the images taken by the cameras. So to a very sophisticated degree, you could study the images, the pictures, and so forth.
That's right, yeah.
So we are interested in your thoughts on this. 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I want to bring in another guest, and this is Margaret Hu of Washington and Lee University. She is a law professor who specializes in cyber surveillance and national security law. She joins us by phone. And Margaret, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Could you lay out for us how this software could be beneficial?
Well, the way that the government would argue that it's beneficial is that it helps with basically pre-crime, that it helps to detect problems before they occur so that the government can take preemptive action. And so this is among many other types of programs that are under a test pilot phase right now, including programs such as the Future Attribute Screening Technology Program at the Department of Homeland Security that attempt to use biometric surveillance or tracking of the body or physiological characteristics to try to predict crime or terrorism before it occurs.
And certainly we could point, for example, well, this would be a case of terrorism after it occurs, but we've certainly seen in the case of the Tsarnaev brothers that it was combing through video cameras or video camera footage that enabled them to help isolate the two people that they believe were responsible for the bombings. So in that sense, you could see how law enforcement could make an argument that this is helpful in terms of not just pre-crime, but solving crimes after they happen.
Yeah, certainly in the Boston bombing case, that was the argument that the surveillance actually helped to capture the suspect.
And so tell us more about what concerns you have, or at least what you've seen in your research about how something that could be quite helpful in law enforcement can also be used inappropriately.
Well, I think that what's very important to understand is that these new biometric matching technologies are very early on in their development and testing and evaluation. And in multiple studies, it's very unclear whether they are sufficiently accurate enough to serve the purposes that the government claims that they can serve. And so one is the accuracy. The next, your other guests had pointed out the efficacy, whether or not they really are used in a purpose that is reliable and can actually stop crime, for example, before it occurs. But the broader constitutional implications, I think, are also important to keep in mind, and including whether or not this really is a violation of the Fourth Amendment and whether or not it constitutes an unreasonable search or seizure of the biometric data.
So cameras, I think many people realize, are a fact of life today, particularly in big urban areas. That's a trend that is unlikely to go in the other direction. Cade Crockford of the ACLU, given that that's a reality and that there will be software developed to try to then work through all that imagery, what do you think are the precautions that need to be put in place to make sure that civil liberties are abided by?
Well, first, I want to take issue with the premise of your question just a little bit, because 15 years ago, nobody thought that gay people would have equal rights in this country. 50 years ago, nobody thought that people would stop smoking. No one wore seatbelts 50 years ago. So it's possible, actually, that we can just take all the cameras down and decide that this was a terrible idea and a failure, which would be great from my view. But if we didn't do that and we decided that, in fact, the cameras should remain in some places, I think the critical question that we're facing now is whether we want to even use on a mass scale technologies like automated tracking, technologies that enable law enforcement officers potentially from hundreds of miles away to track one individual person as they move, you know, from the time they leave their home in the morning until the time they come home at night, everywhere they go throughout the city through a networked surveillance camera system, whether we want private companies and governments to be using biometric tools to track our every movement, to pair that information with all of the data that they collect about us in innumerable databases, essentially eliminating anonymity and privacy in public. Now, you know, the law professor, I'm sorry, I forget her name.
Margaret Hu.
Margaret said that one of the issues we have to examine is whether or not these kinds of surveillance are constitutional under the Fourth Amendment. I would submit that the Constitution is a floor, not a ceiling, and that we as citizens in this democracy can decide, actually, whether we want our police departments to use biometric tracking tools, even if courts or legislatures ultimately decide that they fall within the boundaries of the Fourth Amendment.
And Chris Rohn of Dig Boston, your issue, picking up from where Cade left off, is also that if it is going to be used, you have a lot of concerns about retention, who keeps it, how long they keep it. What did you find in your reporting about places that do have that kind of policy in place? What have they decided to do and what feels appropriate?
Well, I mean, that's the conversation that has to be had. I've found a lot of examples, more so actually, of places that don't have them in place. We've seen this with the Boston Police Department with automatic license plate readers. Correct me if I'm wrong, Cade, the police department had put forth a policy that they allegedly had and then released information accidentally to the Boston Globe and to Muck Rock, noting that they had, in fact, had much more data. And on top of that, as the example that we're dealing with in Dig Boston shows, there are these third-party contractors. Now, that's more information. I'll also add that there's the whole Joint Terrorism Task Force apparatus. And in this, you know, post-9/11 era, there's allegedly a lot of communication between federal agencies, state agencies, city agencies. As we saw in the wake of the Marathon bombing, they're not always coordinated. You know, we had federal authorities, federal officials saying, we gave the city this information. And then we had Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis say, they didn't show it to us. So if that's what we're talking about, if that's the infrastructure, then how can they be responsible with this amount of data? As we've seen, sometimes it surfaces on the internet more than a year after the fact.
Chris and Margaret and Kate, I want to go to some callers. We have Paul calling from Chinatown. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think this whole conversation is somewhat troubling. I primarily agree with the representative from the ACLU. The idea of pre-crime and such like that, monitoring individuals, I think we should always choose freedom over security. I mean, that is a primary tenet of our American society. And we know that government agencies like the NSA and others will continue to collect more and more data and not be forthcoming even with legislators about that information that they do collect. I think, you know, I understand that there are, you know, stoplight cameras and such, but when we're talking about using this analytics to determine if someone is suspicious, and they may be, but have not committed a crime, and then is being stopped and questioned, frisked by the police or anything like that, I think we've really lost what America is. And
Paul, how in your mind do you balance this out with what law enforcement say is the safety aspect of this? For example, we've talked again about the Sarnaya brothers. Would they have been found as quickly if they hadn't had camera footage?
Yes, and they wouldn't have, because we have you know, information from the NSA that says that we've stopped all of these terrorist attacks, but they are not willing to give forth any of that information. And then when the information they do give forth, it is found that they haven't stopped any. So it is somewhat farcical to say that we're collecting all this data to keep you safe, but it is in fact not, and we're monitoring our own citizens. I think it is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Paul, thank you for calling. Cade Crawford, looks like you have something you want to add.
I just wanted to add that the ACLU's position is not that zero surveillance ever is appropriate in a democracy. You know, when the police obtain a warrant to spy on someone, that is usually legitimate. In situations like the Boston Marathon, at the finish line of a race where there are thousands of people, there are TV cameras, there are people taking personal videos, that's not really an issue to have surveillance there. What we're really talking about is pervasive monitoring of every person in this city, in this state, in this country. So everywhere you go, everything you do is
just
monitored.
Because it can be done.
Exactly. And this is not the kind of society we want to live in, I submit. Yeah.
I want to go to another caller. This is Jennifer from Jamaica Plain. Jennifer, thanks for calling, and you're on the air.
Hi. So one of my big concerns is about the security of this data. Just saying this is available on the internet, that someone could easily get this information. I have patients who are victims of domestic violence, and also people who are in the witness protection program. People looking for them might use this information to track them down.
That's very
frightening to me.
If it is publicly available, which Chris, as you found, with certain amount of digging, it is possible.
Absolutely, and you know that's naturally a concern. I'll even put it in the other direction, in that what we end up with is just what authorities end up with is this giant haystack. I call it the infopocalypse. There's an inordinate amount of data out there, and they really have to be more, not just to appease civil liberties advocates. They really have to be more. They have to be smarter about the way that they store it and the way that it's parsed, or else there's just – I can't even imagine how they could go back through it.
Margaret Hu of Washington and Lee University, I'd like to get your legal perspective on this. When you hear about concerns like that, that there could sort of be unintended victims because suddenly your personal information is available online, perhaps in footage, what are the precautions that need to be in place, or what is out there that you consider is working that would ease that concern?
Well, I think that we definitely need a new statutory structure for the digital age, and the laws that we have in place are really outdated. So the last time Congress really tackled this seriously was in the 1980s, and it's been light years away considering all the advancements that we've had in technology since. So I do think that for a lot of these database protections and electronic communications protections, that it's something that Congress needs to take seriously.
And I should note, Chris, that this story that ran last week in The Dig was the first of a series you do, and there is more to come. You'll look at, for example, cost, who covers this kind of technology and other issues. What else can we expect coming up in the paper?
Really a lot of the history. So I'm going to get into really how did this relationship with IBM and Boston developed? And it appears that IBM often, and Boston is certainly not the only city, there are dozens across the country where they will have these programs, they offer grants. And in my opinion, those grants turn into a bunch of experts descending on a municipality and essentially drafting a proposal, which in Boston's case, it fell hook, line, and sinker for, to the tune of, yeah, I'll be breaking down the money, but it's certainly in excess of $1 million several year after year after year, beginning in about 2010. But as far as the camera infrastructure, the hardware that this software runs on, that a lot of that's been in place since 2004, the Democratic National Convention. And we'll be getting into that. And then for a third installment, we'll be really looking forward. What's the future of it? Also looking at the state level.
That will all be in Dig Boston. This has been Chris Ferrone. Thank you very much for coming to the studio, one of the reporters of the paper. Also with us, Cade Crockford, Director of the Technology for Liberty Project at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Cade, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
And by phone, Margaret Hu, a law professor at Washington and Lee University who specializes in cyber surveillance and national security law. Margaret, thank you to you, too.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, bluesman Chris Smither celebrates 50 years in the music business. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.